Welcome to the 165th episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Rutherford. Stay tuned for my interview with best-selling author Dean Koontz. Koontz's new novel, The City, was published this week. Stay tuned for the interview. The Reading and Writing Podcast is sponsored by the book-loving nerds at Riffle. Riffle is an online book community that connects readers with authors and books that they'll love. Readers use Riffle to find the next book that they want to read. And authors use Riffle to make their books stand out and drive sales. Join the Riffle community today at rifflebooks.com. That's RIFFLEBOOKS.com. And look for the link in the show notes as well. Well, welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm extremely excited today to interview Dean Koontz. If you've been in a bookstore in the last 30 years, Koontz almost needs no introduction, but I'll give you one anyway. 14 of Koontz's novels have risen to number one on the New York Times bestseller list, including One Door Away from Heaven, From the Corner of His Eye, The Husband, Relentless, and many other novels. The City, Koontz's latest novel, has just been published this week. Dean Koontz, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me there.
Great. Well, if someone listening hasn't heard about your new novel yet, The City, how would you describe The City?
Well, it's something I've never tried before in the narrative approach. It's told by a 57-year-old piano man who is looking back on something that happened to him when he was 8, 9, and 10. So you've got this adult voice, but telling a story in which a child figures the center. And his name is Jonah Ellington, Basie Hines, Eldridge Wilson Hampton Armstrong Kirk. And most of those names would resonate with people who didn't know jazz or he didn't know big band music. But Jonah comes from a family of people who are musicians and rather good ones. His mother is a struggling singer. His grandfather was a well-known piano man. And Jonah's telling you about some wondrous, amazing, mystical, sometimes frightening things that happened to him when he was 8, 9, and 10 and how they shaped his entire life. And it's really a story about families and a mother-son relationship and the fact that the world, from my point of view and from Jonah's, is a deeply mysterious place of many layers. And we can't always see the world as a strictly material place because things happen to us that are, in their way, if not supernatural, preternatural. And I think that's the closest I can come to summing it up because it's a kind of complex story.
Sure, sure. Well, as I understand, you initially started writing The City intending for it to be a novella for your publisher, but I understand that kind of got away from you. Can you talk about what happened when you wrote The City?
Yeah, I was, these days, you know, they want you to write an e-single in order to interest people in your next book and to pre-order and whatnot. And I was sitting down to write a story that would be set in the same universal city that Innocence was set in. And I was a fan many years ago of all those 87th Precinct novels by Ed McBain, sure, in which he invents his own city. It's a variation of New York, but it isn't New York. And so I thought that's interesting, and it gives you a kind of interesting challenge and freedom as well. To invent your own city. So I said, well, I'll set the story promoting Innocence in the same universal city, and that'll be the only link. So I started to write it, and my publisher was waiting for it. And when I hit page 50 or 60, I realized, man, this isn't going to be a novelette. This is going to be a novel. So I had already delivered the novel for this summer. It's called Secret Forest, and they had liked it a lot, and it was in the schedule, and I made the mistake, or had a stroke of wisdom, I don't know which, of sending them 30 pages or so of The City and said, what do you think of this? And they came back so overwhelmingly positive. They said, we really love Secret Forest, but this is the perfect book to follow Innocence with. Can you write this in time? And I had a number of months, and I looked at it and said, I think I can. And then it just grew and grew. It was one of the most pleasant writing experiences of my life. Very few times was I sitting here wanting to nail my hand to the desk or punish myself in some way for being such an incompetent idiot writing it. It just flowed and flowed, and was exhilarating.
That's great. Well, as you mentioned earlier, the Jonah, the narrator of the city, is a musician. What connections do you see between music and your own chosen art form, writing fiction?
I think in all art forms, it's interconnected because it's an attempt at beauty. It's an attempt to portray the beauty of the world, or I think that's basically one of the core functions of literature, even if it's meant to be a dark and scary kind of literature, which this book isn't meant to be, but I've certainly written some that were. And whatever you're after, you're looking for some way to explain the world or an aspect of the world and to explore the world's beauty. And music certainly does that. Architecture does that. Art does that. And it's never been a surprise to me that almost every artist I've known or illustrator has in his heart wanted to be a novelist. And so many novelists I've known, including myself, at one time painted or wanted to be a visual artist. And then there's many writers who have some musical talent as well, but maybe, and certainly in my case, not equal to the ability to handle the language. So I think all the arts are intertwined in a curious way that we don't often recognize. And it's, they're our way of trying to explain the world to ourselves, humanity to ourselves, and purpose of our lives to ourselves. And that's why I get upset with how many contemporary novels are nihilistic and say the world has no meaning and nothing you do has any meaning. And that always raises in my mind, why did the writer write the book? Because by the writer's own philosophy, the book has no meaning. That's not the way I work. And that's a long, rambling answer, but I hope it was coherent.
No, I think it was coherent. That actually brings up a good point, because I know just from reading previous interviews and articles that, you know, especially when you were starting out, that you would read sometimes 150 to 200 novels a year as you were trying to, not only enjoy reading, but learning the craft of fiction. I wonder, do you find yourself reading as much fiction these days?
I don't find myself reading as much, partly because the older I get, as the kind of books I'm writing gain depth, because you either grow deeper as you go older or you flatline. And I look at an idea that I would write the last 15 years, say, as to one 15 years before that. These require a lot more research. And so I find myself reading a lot of books about the subjects I'm writing about rather than reading fiction for fiction's sake. And but I still read probably 30, 40 novels a year. Sure. So I don't give it up altogether. But
yeah. Well, I know over the years you've changed from following an outline for your novels to writing much more instinctually. What caused that change for you? And along those lines, do you ever find that you write yourself into a corner and have to back up and throw away several chapters?
Well, you know, I always wrote to an outline, but well, let's just say this. I would write an outline, then I would sell it, because in those days I had sold enough that I could sell a book on outline, and then I would go away and write the book. And whatever time frame it was, 6 months, a year later, when I deliver the book, I would think it was much better in the outline, because it varied from the outline. It veered off into different things and new territory, and it was more exciting to me. But I discovered that publishers and editors, they've had a year to think about that outline they bought, and it becomes sort of, it's what they expect you to deliver. And when you didn't deliver what the outline was, and you felt you delivered a better book, they were disappointed because it wasn't exactly what you had promised to deliver them. And at one point I thought, this is self-defeating, and I'm not going to do this anymore. And the first book I wrote, without an outline with Strangers, which has at least 12 major characters and an extremely complicated storyline. And I found it just astonishingly more satisfying to work without an outline, to just let the characters take over and see where this story would go. And curiously or not, that was the first book I had that was a hardcover bestseller. And everything in the career accelerated rapidly once I stopped using outlines. The next book was a bigger bestseller, the one after that, bigger yet, and then the fourth one without an outline was my first number one. I think that for me, and I'm not saying this works for every writer, ditching the outline and going organic just works a great deal better. And as to your question, whether I get to some point and go, uh-oh, it's something I'm terrified of at times in every book, that where is this going? Although less terrified the last few years than previously. I always have moments of fear that this is going to end up without an ending, or it's going to go somewhere that can't be resolved. But it always does work out. And because I write multiple drafts of a page before moving on, and write not a draft and then go back, I just stay on one page 10 times 20 times 30, whatever it takes, until I feel that that page is polished properly, and then I move to the next. I have plenty of time to think ahead to problems, and I've discovered that I might think there's a couple of big problems coming and there's no solution I can immediately see, but I've learned that the subconscious is working on it. And when you get to that troubling moment, you've got two or three solutions to it. So I've never had to back up and destroy anything.
That's great. Well, I know that you, like a lot of writers, write your novels on a computer, but from what I understand, it's not the type of computer most people would expect with the latest software, the latest version of Microsoft Word. Is there a reason you've kind of stuck with that familiar computer technology?
I was on CBS Sunday Morning. The crew was here for about a year or two ago, and Anthony Mason did the interview, and he's really good interview, and they were a great crew, and they were here for 2 days. And the first day, we never got anywhere near my office, and the second day, they did this Steadicam, so they didn't come in and see the office first. And we walked down the hall to my office talking, and the Steadicam guy in front of us, so I walked into the office. Anthony Mason looked at my computer and said, "My God, what is that?" And I said, "Well, you're lucky it's not steam driven." The reason I have such an antiquated system is the first Microsoft 5.0, you could take Windows out of it and you could use all the word processing stuff without Windows. And I hated Windows. And my assistant was very computer savvy, took out the whole Windows feature. But subsequent version of Word, you can't take Windows out. So I'm a guy who just doesn't want to learn a new software and slow down, or be afraid that if I learn and if I'm given a new software, it'll somehow inhibit the flow of my thought until I'm comfortable with it. And I don't want any inhibition of the flow of thought. So I have I can't even get a new monitor because they won't work with this level of Word. I have a spare keyboard that'll work with it, and I have a spare printer that'll work with it. And so until those things burn out, I'm not going to get a new software and waste a few weeks of my life trying to learn it.
Sure, sure. And what is the software? Is it like a version of Word, like a very early?
Very early. It's a DOS system. So that shows you how, you know, there were still mastodons on the earth when I got this computer.
So do you ever scare or surprise yourself while you're writing?
It's very hard to scare yourself, I think, when you're writing. It's something can happen. It maybe gives you a little chill. I think the closest I've ever come to scaring myself was when I was working on Intensity. And I was long from ever doing an outline by that time, and I didn't know where the lead character, China, was going to go. And there comes a moment where she escapes the serial killer in this story. And in fact, he doesn't even know she's there. She's been following him. She's been on his trail for a period of time. But now he's she could escape. She could walk away. And instead, she gets into his motorhome again. And I didn't know she was going to do that. And I had to get up from the chair when it happened and just walk around the room a little bit because it spooked me. More easily, you can make yourself laugh out loud when I'm working on a novel with comic elements like Life Expectancy or one of the odd books. Then I find myself sitting there laughing at some of the dialogue as if I were hearing it instead of writing it. Or you can move yourself to tears in certain situations. But I find that kind of thing much more likely than to scare yourself. And I have no idea why, but that's the way it is with me.
Gotcha. Well, given your success to date, do you ever fear becoming complacent with your writing or being resistant to editing feedback? And if so, what do you do at this point in your career to kind of combat those?
Resistant to editorial feedback. I've never been that way. I know that there are a lot of writers out there who go through periods, I've heard of it, that when they get successful, they say no more editorial feedback or they get resistant to it. I've always had the attitude that the cover of the book doesn't say by Dean Koontz with brilliant suggestions by. if I take a brilliant suggestion from an editor, I'm the one that gets credit for it, so why wouldn't I listen to it? The practical truth of the matter is because I write the way I do and polish each page before moving on, and that comes out of self-doubt, the feeling that I'm always somehow screwing up with this. Because I work that way, editors don't find much to do with it. But when they do, if I disagree, we'll have a good back and forth. And if I agree, I'll just take it and find a way to get in there what the editor's asking me for. Let's see, you had another part to that question, but I just...
It's okay. I was just the first part of it was, do you ever fear becoming complacent given your success, specifically in terms of your writing? And I guess related to that, do you give yourself new challenges with each book?
That's been one of the... I say to young writers, if you really want to be somebody who tries to stretch constantly, get ready, because you're going to run into publishers and editors who won't like that. When I was at Putnam and was writing, really breaking through, I had a publisher who loved publishing writers who did the very same thing over and over again. And some of them could be wonderful at what they did, like Dick Francis, but I wasn't like that. And we ended up in terrible brawls over it. I can remember when finally there was a period where I said, look, I'm going to have to go somewhere else if there's not going to be a willingness to promote and push what I write instead of trying to push me into writing what is wanted. And I had thought we'd broken through with Strangers, and then Watchers was a larger bestseller. But then I delivered Lightning, and Lightning was, to this publisher's way of thinking, too different. She said to me, look, the first quarter of this book, the character is a child. You can't do that. It becomes a young adult novel. And I started to wonder about books like Oliver Twist and whatnot. I don't think that rule makes any sense. And she said to me, look, your career is accelerating. You're a hardcover bestseller now. We'll need to put Lightning on the shelf for 7 years, and then I'll publish it. But if we publish it now, it'll throw a roadblock into your career and you may never recover from it. And I just didn't believe that. I also wondered, why not 5 years and why not nine? Why seven? where did that insight come from? And I think we had a 6-month argument about this, and she finally published it, but with very little support. And yet it went to number three. And the very next book after that was Midnight, and we went to number one. And ever since, until my current publishing team, I have hit resistance when I come up with something different. Why don't you go back and write, give us a good monster story, or give us a good this or that. And if I were to do that, I would have stopped years ago, because it's all too potentially boring to write the same thing over and over again. So what keeps me from being complacent, I think, is that I have a low boredom threshold. And if I were to just keep writing the same thing over and over, I couldn't do it. It would just be too tedious. So finding a new thing, like I remember when I delivered the first Odd Thomas, my publisher hated that book so much. He wouldn't talk to me about it. And that was okay for me rather than fight about it. And I was fortunate that my editor loved it. So there were two very strong different opinions about it. As it turned out, the public liked the character very much, and I was able to do more with him. And so you just, complacency, I think, comes from thinking you've found what succeeds. Now you just need to keep doing it. And I don't think anything succeeds for a long time unless you change and grow and what you're doing morphs into something different and hopefully better.
That's a great answer. So I know from previous interviews and your early books that you wrote about writing that, that you're a student of the publishing business as a business. So I have an interesting question for you. If you woke up tomorrow and you were a 22-year-old Dean Koontz and you were living in 2014 and starting a writing career, knowing what you know about Amazon and the ability to self-publish and the way that ebooks are changing or adapting the publishing business, do you think that you would be tempted to self-publish your own novels digitally, or would you still pursue traditional publication with a New York publishing house?
Everything is changing, of course, and that's the way life always is. But I would argue that the traditional method, a publisher who has the system and the distribution system and a team of everybody from cover designers to copy editors to page designers, those are things that a writer can't do. Can't do all of them. So there may be some writers with an artistic eye that can devise a great cover and a great page, because a lot of the self-published books I see coming from, indie authors who publish through these various companies, they're poorly designed books. And I really think that there's a lot of things about a good book design that works subconsciously on the reader, the type font, the layout of the page, all that may seem insignificant to a young writer, but I think it can be very important. And I really respect the team that works with me and all of their knowledge and what they do. And I know that I don't have that knowledge. I know that some people have had success with the ebook format, and it's led in some cases to regular book publication by a regular publisher. But I still think that until there's further change, the old way of doing it still offers the writer the greatest, surest path to success. The ebooks are exciting and everything else, but and I'm happy to sell the ebooks, but I like the full spectrum method of publication, and I just like having the feedback from truly talented professionals in each of their fields in a publishing house, because they provide invaluable help to you in promoting that book and just in general, making sure it's something in the marketplace that a reader passes by and looks at and goes, ooh, I got to have that.
Sure. Well, I have to ask, will we see a third Christopher Snow novel?
We definitely will. I'm writing the last Odd Thomas now. It's St. Odd. And when that's finished, I have... the city comes in the, as I said, in this sort of universal city or this prototypical city. And I want to write a third novel set in that same background. And one has come to my mind that I'm quite excited about. So I think when I finish St. Odd, I will write that first. Then I'll go back to Ride the Storm, third Chris Snow. The reason I stopped the Chris Snow thing is it was supposed to be the three first books I delivered when I moved to Bantam were to be Fear Nothing and Seize the Night and Ride the Storm. And Fear Nothing was met with delight at the publishing house and my editor. But again, my publisher was unsure of Seize the Night. He thought it got too funny, thought it went a little too over the top or something, and wanted me to scale it back. And I was kind of exhausted because I had moved to this publishing house because I thought we wouldn't have some of these disagreements, and we did. And I said, okay, I think I need to put the third Christopher Snow aside until I've delivered a couple, one or two more books, and then we'll be on a surer footing. We'll know each other better, and I can go back to Ride the Storm, and they'll understand what I was doing. But then the next book was False Memory, and the one after that was From the Corner of His Eye, and the next thing I knew, I was on to One Doorway to Heaven. And all these years have passed, and I never did get back to Ride the Storm, but I am determined to finish it, and I have slotted out a big block of time next year to do it.
Great. Well, I know that you wrote two earlier books about writing that are now out of print, and you've mentioned in passing a few times that you might write a third book about writing. Do you have any current plans to write a nonfiction book about the writing process?
I would like to write one, but it would probably be noticeably different from the two that I published many years ago. Those were, I would say, the first one was out of date before it had hardly been published. The second one was better, and it was, however, I would say it was more mechanical, technical. I would argue that over the years I've learned that all of that's important, all of that mechanical and technical things about writing are still important, like staying within one point of view within a scene and all the different things that come up like that. But what I've learned through experience and all these books later, I would approach it in a different way writing about it. I would write it, if I were doing a How to Write Now, I would make the point of each of us has a voice that he or she has to find, and finding that voice is central to your work. And if you find that voice and it comes naturally to you, and you what young writers often tend to do is imitate what they like the most, that they get past that, some sooner than others, and that's what you have to do, is get past trying to write like the things you enjoy reading, and learning to write what's true to you, who you are as a person, what's true to your heart, and that voice that is yours, and not simply a kind of attempt to imitate a voice that you particularly like. So I would write about finding your voice. I'd write about all those elements that of writing fiction that are extremely mysterious. For instance, where do you get ideas? I could do chapters, I think, on where ideas come from, and in addition, where they come from, about those ideas that seem to come from nowhere. I have said often that when the idea for Odd Thomas came to me, I was working on The Face, and I was sitting here and perfectly happy with The Face, and it was going well, and I finished a chapter, and into my head came these lines: my name is Odd Thomas, I live an unusual life. And it had nothing to do with the book I was writing, and I recognized it was an opening to another book. I turned to write it down, and the next thing I knew, I was writing longhand, which I never do, and I wrote page after page on a legal tablet, longhand, and when I was done, I had the first chapter of Odd Thomas, and I looked at it and thought, this could be something special, and I put it aside, went back to The Face, and then wrote Odd Thomas after. And where did that come from? I don't know. I sometimes think the subconscious is the most important tool that a writer has going for him. It links us to the world in a way that the conscious doesn't. Some people would say there isn't a subconscious, and then you get into some other more mystical ideas about where these ideas come to you from. I think idea formation and how, once the idea begins, you get out of the way of it would be one of the most interesting things I could write about writing, because getting out of the way of it is a large part about what writing is. I have a friend who's a drummer who has played with some very famous people, and said to me that we were talking one day, and he said when he's drumming his best, and he knows it's his best because he kind of goes away, and when the whole performance is over, the show is over, the other guys in the group will say to him, what the hell were you doing? Do that every time. That was great. And he'll say, I don't remember what I did. And he said, when I'm best, it starts to happen and I get out of my own way. And that resonated with me because that's exactly what happens when it's going well for me. I have to get out of my own way. I have to stop thinking about why this is happening, where it's going. I'd have to give myself to it. And I think writing about that probably would be helpful to young writers. So someday I may do that, but it wouldn't be your typical how to write book, I don't think.
Sure. Sure. Well, you mentioned earlier, and what you just said, I think was great and would be great advice for any writer to aspiring writer to listen to. But, you mentioned earlier about the last Odd Thomas novel that's slated for later this year in December, St. Odd. Do you care to talk about St. Odd at all?
Well, I'll talk about it a little bit. You know, this, I never quite realized I would write, you know, including Odd Interlude, which was an interim little long novella or short novel, however you want to see it. I'm ending up with 8 books in the series, and there's things unanswered that all have to be answered in the last, and I've long known where it goes, and of course the whole series keeps repeating this little card that he and Stormy Llewellyn got out of the fortune-telling machine when they were 16, which says you're destined to be together forever. That I take to be a promise, and how that will be fulfilled at the end, given what's happened in the first book, will probably be different than anybody's expecting. And so I'm looking forward to getting to that part of the book. There's also been a number of characters arise in the series that readers keep writing me. They want to know, are they going to appear again? What happens to them and so forth? And I want to fulfill some of that as well. It's a good experience sitting here working on it, but at the same time, it's kind of a bad one, a sad one maybe is a better word for it, because when you get really close to a character and it comes to the end of the story, it does feel like you're letting go of somebody who is an actual human being in your life. And that probably sounds to some people like I should be institutionalized, but in fact, I might need to be institutionalized, but not for that reason. A character who comes that alive for you is a great gift, and it's a sad thing to let go of it.
That's great. Well, you've often mentioned Watchers as your favorite novel of yours that you've written. Is that still the case for you?
I would say I was asked, I'm trying to remember which interview, maybe it was a thing for this New York Times book review feature that's coming up. And I was asked what were my favorites of my own books. And I pretty rapidly typed out The City, Innocence, From the Corner of His Eye, Life Expectancy, and Odd Thomas, and Watchers. So I think now that there's a number of them that I would say I'm just as happy with as I was with that one. But, you know, it's just very hard to write a book that has a dog with human intelligence. And everybody loves that. They love the whole idea of the dog who you can talk to, which is every sort of child's fantasy of being able to have his dog as a full-fledged friend whom he can discuss things with. That kind of story is a hard one to follow, that people will like something else as well as that. And it's a hard one for a writer himself to like something better than that. But I've come around over the years to liking a number of others as well.
That's great. Well, you just mentioned dogs, and you've mentioned that you believe dogs will be in heaven. So I'd be remiss to ask, what about cats?
Well, I love cats, but there's a problem with me and cats. I am so allergic to cats that if I were to walk, sometimes I forget to ask a new acquaintance, do you have a cat? Because if I walk into a house where somebody has a cat, I go into anaphylactic shock, and it doesn't matter how clean the house is or anything else. It's a mere presence of the cat. And my eyes start to swell shut. My throat starts to swell shut. I have to inject myself with 2 EpiPens in the thigh, drink a little bottle of Benadryl, and get to a hospital. So when people say, you must hate cats, you don't write about them very often. And I said, it isn't that I hate them. They seem to hate me.
Great. Well, again, we've been speaking with bestselling writer Dean Koontz. Dean's latest novel, The City, was published this week. It's in bookstores now, so go grab a copy. And as we've mentioned, the last Odd Thomas novel, St. Odd, will be published later this year in December. And Dean, thanks for doing this interview today.
Oh, thanks for having me there. The time went very quickly.
It did.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.